Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Rishabh Kohl. Rishabh is a seasoned founder, operator and investor specializing in the early stages of venture growth. Based in London, Rishabh is the founder of Swagat, a platform championing the rise of South Asians in tech across Europe. He's held leadership roles in groundbreaking startups and co-founded Belong, an AI-powered HR tech platform backed by Sequoia, Matrix, and Bloom Ventures. He also runs Goodfellas, a syndicate investing in cutting-edge SaaS and developer tools. When he's not building or investing, Rishabh shares his insights through his newsletter, blog, and podcast. In today's episode, we talk about the fact that all Indians know each other, they just haven't met yet. How one in two tier two visas are going to Indians in the UK, how you move from survival mode to building as immigrants, how to build an India-Europe corridor to rival the India Silicon Valley one, and will the next talent hub for Indian startups be Europe? Does India suffer from a PR problem in European tech? And is Europe just a stepping stone to the US for Indians in tech? How he has built a community of 200 founders and operators from the Indian diaspora and putting the value up front. Rishabh's contrarian advice, some people would be better off buying rather than building a venture. Let's get straight into it.
This is Nothing Ventured with me, Ari Shah, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture capital ecosystem go round. I've been working with startups from pre-seed to Series C for the last decade, and companies that I've worked with have gone on to realize value and exit or raise funds in excess of $500 million. I really hope you enjoy the episode, and if you have a guest that you'd love to see me have on, or you have a comment on any of the episodes that I've recorded so far, do reach out to me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd love to hear from you. Let's get straight into it.
Well, let's jump straight in. A lot of what you do and what you have been doing is around South Asian tech professionals. So how do you think the increasing presence of these South Asian tech professionals is going to impact the next 15 years in the European talent ecosystem?
So I think it can play out in different ways. One of the ways to see what would happen is to look at how it's happened in other places. If you look at the US, the first wave of people that moved there were entrepreneurial, but they weren't necessarily entrepreneurs in the venture-backable sense, right? The first set of people that move for opportunities. Mm-hmm. Because I think immigrants need two things, right? They need some sort of financial cushion and they need clarity on immigration.
Yeah.
If you give them these two things, everything else gets taken care of. They're extremely close-knit. They're ambitious. They know how to hustle. They're frugal. All the sort of usual.
And that topics. First wave, from your perspective, would probably, like, so if you look at the US, it would have been the motel owners or the gas stations and those sort of things.
So I think that could be one wave. But I think what I'm specifically talking about is the wave of people that came during the 60s mm-hmm. and the 70s to work in the universities. Uh-huh. So this is when the Man on the Moon mission was happening. There was a lot of funding for sponsoring education of people. And so the people that came in the 60s, 70s to work, during the Cold War era or things like that, you know, these are the people that came and got their PhDs in electrical and computer science and things like that. They ended up joining companies like Intel and, the traitorous 8 and spent time in Bay Area and things like that. And so I think once they started working, built a network, built some sort of a financial cushion, you then see people like Vinod Khosla and the likes coming out from there. Mm-hmm. And once these people did well, they then, A, inspired the next generation of people to come in. And B, when they had kids and that group, those people already had the kind of, a safety net to start off with. And so they could think of starting up on day one, right?
Yeah.
Leading up all the way today where you have like every flight between Bangalore and San Francisco is filled with founders, right? It's either founders or tech operators. Mm-hmm. And we sort of reached that stage now. And I think in Europe, I think there's obviously a historical link between India and Europe. especially the UK.
Yeah, but a very different relationship.
A very different relationship, right? And there could be lots of different reasons for that. But regardless of whatever the reasons are, the end result is if you look at who the richest Indians in Europe are, they're not from technology. They are entrepreneurs, but they're not technology entrepreneurs.
Pharmaceuticals.
Right? Hospitality, real estate, hotels, FMCG, you know, things like that. There are quite a few folks who've started doing well. And some people who have done well, but probably are not known to the masses, right? Like, for example...
They're not household names.
Yeah, like probably everybody has used the app Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
One of the founders was Indian, right? And he's Brit, Dheeraj. I don't know how many people know about him.
I mean, I didn't. Right? Yeah.
It's now... So I started spending time thinking about what this would lead to, right? Now, if you sort of extrapolate this for the next 15 years, today, I think one in two... or like about 40% of tier two visa holders in the UK, which is a skilled worker visa, that visa is given to Indians.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at global talent visa, which is the UK's version of the O-1 in the US, mm-hmm. right, which de-links immigration and your employment, I think 15% is given to Indians. You obviously have a massive diaspora already present here, the second generation Indians. I think last I checked, it was across Europe. If you look at all South Asians, I think it's about 8 million. Mm-hmm. I think Indians are about probably four mm-hmm. from there, 3.5, 4 or something like that. I mean, these guys are going to have kids and there's going to be more people coming to UK. And with U.S. immigration becoming a bit more tricky in the years to come.
Well, so certainly in the last week, it's become a lot trickier. Yeah, sure.
So, a lot of those people are going to land up in UK, mm-hmm. right? I mean, or different parts of Europe.
Sure.
I mean, even European
wherever Union is most fairly, accessible, right?
Yeah. I think in European Union, you could get permanent residency in about, I don't know, like 21 months in mm-hmm. Germany.
Yeah.
If you learn the language, probably lesser. And so which other developed economy in the world is going to give you permanent residency between 21 to 36 months
mm-hmm.
Without having to invest like, you know, $1 million or something like that? And I think all of these reasons are going to be extremely valuable for, you know, educated Indians who are hungry, aspirational. They have to hustle their way to get here. But I think there's more and more people coming in and there's a... It's a bit of a chain reaction, right? It just requires you to have one person in your team.
Yeah.
And the moment they become a hiring manager, they're going to bring in four of their buddies. And when they become directors, it's a matter of time. They're going to set up an India center. We've seen this game played out. And if you get an exit, this person is going to quit and become a VC.
Yeah.
And so over the next sort of 10, 12 years, I think, like if one were to paint a picture of what would Europe look like, I think it's especially in, you know, cities like London, Berlin, Amsterdam, there's going to be a very large number of you know, South Asians, especially Indians in technology.
Mm-hmm.
They are going to be at the CXO level. I think there will be an identity associated with Indians in tech,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't really exist in Europe to the extent that it exists.
No, and I was going to say, like, if you correlate that sort of first wave of migration into the US and look at it in say the UK's perspective, I would think, and I don't have any data to back this up, that first wave are that first wave of doctors and accountants and lawyers, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Who then kind of put their kids through private education into universities, who then either have also become sort of doctors, lawyers, and accountants, but a lot of them are now sort of realizing that this wasn't the path that they wanted to take. I mean, it was certainly a massive realization for me, right? Coming out 20 years after coming out of university, that hold on a second, that pathway, which was the tried and trodden and tested path of, you know, send your kids to university, go to, you know, then get a job with PwC or with Deutsche Bank or whoever it was, is actually not necessarily right for now that second, third generation of diaspora that's here, right?
Yeah, I think there's two ways to look at it. One is that the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree. So
that's true.
I think when we become parents, I don't know how different we will be from our.
I have two grown up kids, so I know exactly what I'm like as a parent. I've been pushing my elder one. Like my elder one wants to do work in with big animals, so that's a completely different. Like I'm like, yeah, go for it. Younger one is still trying to figure it out, and I what I tell her is. You know, she's turning 17 soon. And I'm saying, look, don't worry about what you do at university because the world in 5 years is going to be very different from the world today. And actually, what I would hope for someone like her is that, yeah, she maybe does do a bit of the traditional, whatever it is, the job, the career. But, you know, if she has the ambition or the smarts, so she could go out and really drive something and build something herself.
Yeah. And I think it comes from within, right? Where you're like, hey, I think every generation tries to make it a little bit better for the next generation, right? And so if you're like, hey, you know what? You don't need to worry about survival, right? Mm. You've gotten a great education. Mm. You might start your career with, you know, a couple of gigs at, you know, startups or well-known brands or whatever. Post that, now what? Because I think the every subsequent generation has this need to sort of express themselves in different ways, and I think in the current day and age, like I remember joining a startup or starting something used to be this one-off thing that people used to do. Now it's like the most the least mainstream thing that you could do is join Procter & Gamble, right? Like people be like, oh wow, that's something different.
No, but it's interesting, right? So I would agree for like the generation say coming up after me, but
yeah.
For my generation, it's still anathema for a lot. Like my parents didn't really understand maybe don't understand what I do, right? Because it's just a different path and one that, you know, one that they themselves didn't have role models for, to your earlier point. Whereas I think now for me certainly and with the new generation, I'm not necessarily looking at just Europe, but you look at the US and you have Sundar Pichai and you have, you know, all of these titans, all of these titanic tech companies essentially being run by people from the Indian diaspora, and you have names like Vinod Khosla and others, you have those role models now, and it's easier to kind of make that jump or even convince people that this is actually a legitimate way to move forward in your life, right?
Yeah.
And so I guess like the, you know, in terms of 15 years from now, it sounds like what you're saying is you think that A, there will be a larger proportion of diaspora in Europe, and B, they will start coalescing in a way that will A, build great businesses and attract more talent to come, and it becomes a virtuous cycle, right? On the assumption, and this is the thorny question, I guess, that neither you or I necessarily have the answer for or would want to answer.
Immigration.
Is immigration, right? Like, and how that topic will be handled by these various countries, and we're already seeing clearly, you know, some of the direction of travel there.
So on that, right, if you think of it, technology in Europe is probably, I mean, in the current venture scale form and all of that stuff, is probably, I don't know, 15 years old.
Yeah.
Like it started with Skype.
Yeah.
Prior to that, probably you had small exits here and there, maybe one-off, but like Skype sort of was the first big company. Now you've had so many more. Yes. The alumni of Skype have gone ahead and
Spotify, Shazam, as you said.
Yeah, TransferWise, Revolut, whatever, right?
Yeah.
And so technology is not a 5-decade-old phenomenon. So it's probably just running its first cycle, right? Which is a fund was launched and then probably the first funds that were launched are now seeing their exits and things like that.
And we talk about this a lot actually on the podcast in that, you know, Europe feels like it's a mature ecosystem, but it actually isn't, right? So US has been going since the 60s, right? Traitorous, et cetera, as you mentioned. Yeah. Venture capital as an asset class was prominent there for decades before it became
a thing. So Europe is definitely mature as an innovation ecosystem, right? Sure. Because the universities have been there the longest time. And so cool tech has come out of Europe for a long time, but converting that into commercial enterprises, which have seen the entire cycle of scale, public acquisition at a massive scale, like technology companies which are employing like 10,000 people, 5,000 people. It's something, you know, which is new. And so that is one reality. And the other reality is of geopolitics, which is you have Brexit. You one of the largest sources of talent used to be Russia. That's not an option anymore. And so there's the other phenomenon that a lot of Chinese people come to study in Europe, in the UK for sure, but then they go back. And so if you believe that technology is going to continue to increase, and that absolutely seems like that's what all the governments are talking about, who's going to work in these companies when the continent is aging?
How do you bring the right talent in? So, which is why we've seen, again, like, you know, what, a 700 net migration into the UK. The majority of that migration was actually from South Asia.
And so either Europe will dramatically increase the number of STEM graduates, and those things take time.
That starts at kindergarten. It doesn't start.
That's going to take time. Or they make it so hard that founders are going to start offshoring. I mean, like, the Revolut founder is in Dubai right now, right? Like, he's running it out of there. Deliveroo has set up a center in India. I think Clio recently set up an office in Chennai. I mean, obviously, there are, you know, people from the diaspora who are
in the businesses here.
In the leadership positions there who absolutely had a role to play. But I think you can't stop something that's working, right? And so I think Europe has to decide that they want to be able to, they want to continue to attract, you know, talent. And, you know, you can put safeguards and stuff like that, but like you can't say that we're going to make it really hard, because companies are going to find different ways to set up. I recently wrote a post about what if European countries suddenly start setting up offshoring units in Dubai. I mean, European talent would be thrilled to go to Dubai, right? Like, if you know that you could always come back to Europe. One of the challenges in the Middle East is that you're not sure about your exit options as a professional. But if imagine you, a company tells, you know what, spend 5 years in Dubai, earn twice what you're earning, and then you can come back.
Tax-free,
You know, like, till we figure out whatever the government wants to do with immigration. Imagine how many takers would be.
And in Middle East and UAE, you already have a large diaspora there as well, Indian diaspora, as well as Filipino and other other countries. I mean, to be honest, it's one of the regions that we're looking at, because we think that there's an opportunity there. A, the amount of capital that's flowing into tech, but B, the lack of kind of operators in the UAE. There's lots of people that come from corporate backgrounds, but not very many from sort of a startup background. But I mean, it sounds like, so overall, 15 years from now, you think there will be a strong presence of South Asians in Europe?
I think London, Berlin, Amsterdam for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about other cities. Like, I'm not sure about something like Paris.
Or Milan, yeah, sure.
You know.
But they also have fewer ties. So the UK obviously has a very strong tie with India, language and so on. You know, if I were to go to India, I would imagine most people in Bangalore or Chennai or Mumbai or wherever aren't sitting there going, how do I get to Paris? They are thinking, how do I get to London? How do I get to Berlin? How do I get to Amsterdam? Yeah. Certainly from a tech perspective, right? Yeah. So in Italy and in France, what I see a lot of is Indian diaspora in service industry, right? So a lot in kitchens and now becoming the restaurateurs and the restaurant owners, but that's where they see the opportunities in those sort of countries, right? So moving on a little bit, and you mentioned this at the beginning, but you and I have discussed that whilst there already exists an India Silicon Valley tech corridor, this doesn't exist in Europe, despite what we've just talked about. So what are the opportunities as well as the challenges in developing a very strong India-Europe corridor? And how can Indian companies leverage that European expertise and vice versa? Yeah. And alongside that, I'd love to understand why we still have gaps in the capital flow between India and Europe, both outbound as well as inbound, and how European funds might be able to learn from US strategies around both venture and talent in India.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I wouldn't say that I would have a clear-cut answer. We can stitch together a narrative basis the little that we know through conversations, and then rest of it is probably conjecture, right? I think normally when you think of capital in technology, it would come from people who have invested in technology before, right? And so if you look at the people who've made money historically, they have not necessarily made their money from technology.
Yeah.
And so it might be strange for them to now go and invest in technology when they have typically made money from public equities or real estate or things like
that. Yeah, it's a very Europe is very industrial, I guess, from that perspective.
Yeah,
or financial.
I think the second part is that if you look at on the other side, right? If you look at companies in India, and if you were to broadly break them into B2B and B2C, right? I actually feel that the B2C companies could actually be very interesting. I think there's two opportunities for startups in India. Mm-hmm. One is look at Europe as a market. Mm-hmm. And the second is look at Europe as a talent.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if... And then third would be look at Europe as a funding source, right? Sure. But like for somebody in India, funding is... You already have enough investors in India. And if they were to raise, they would raise from a US investor. Why would they come to Europe?
Like, and also in India, I think the exit opportunities are now starting to surpass the European ones. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can be a tech company and go public in India.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine for a tech company to go public in Europe today, especially when you look at what's happened to the couple of companies that have gone public, TransferWise, Deliveroo. And you compare that to, you know, companies in India which are like, you know, trading at insane, you know, PE multiples. You're like, wow, it's like 2020 in India right now. But yeah, I think the two big opportunities are, one is looking at Europe as a talent hub. Mm-hmm. I think Indian companies can start looking at Europe for very specialized talent, because one of the things that Europe is really good at, it's got some of the best universities in the world.
Yeah, 100%.
Right? And when I say universities, I mean the entire plethora of the entire apparatus of undergrad, research, PhD, postdoc, right? India has great undergrad, and then people leave and come to do their masters in the US. And so if you look at any field which is relevant today, right? Energy, mechanical, computer science, clinical, even MBA programs, right? I would say like 8 out of 25 universities, or like a third of them, are in Europe. I don't think that's the case with India. I don't think any of in the top 25, you wouldn't find anything. Maybe ISB for MBA, but other than that, I don't think any of the universities would make it to top. Like, they might just make it. So you end up having a lot of specialized talent, especially, and I've spoken to a lot of companies in India, where if you're looking to hire, you know, senior level talent, like a very specialized focus area within AI, or somebody who is like, if you're trying to build like a global product out of India, you're much more likely to find good senior talent in Europe, because they've actually built global products here, right? Like,
but even there, I would say
India's always looked at least for a lot of products as a domestic consumption market, unless it's B2B, in which case they've set it up in the US. But now US salaries are going
that's,
through the
and
roof
I,
as
that's
well.
What I was going to say, because even within Europe, you haven't seen that many people having built global businesses. It's predominantly the US, but the salaries, as you say, in the US are like 3-4x what they are in the UK.
I think there's enough. It's nothing compared to the US, but it's a large number. In fact, I would say if you look at B2B companies, I think the homegrown companies that have come from Europe, and you compare that side by side to the homegrown companies that have come from India, you'll notice that a lot of European companies are truly innovative, in the sense that they created a new category. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Indian companies would have gone after something like a cost performance or something like that. There was a cost arbitrage in the SaaS world, right? And even today, a lot of people talk about that. Hey, you could hire people for, you know, relatively lesser. There's a talent arbitrage and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
You don't hear that in Europe. And so the kinds of companies that come out are genuinely category creators, right? Miro, you know, like even companies which have, where founders have left Europe to go to US and immediately started there. Intercom, Stripe. I mean, you know, in India, you would find Indian equivalents of that.
Sure, but for the Indian
market. Or there would be companies which truly have been built to solve an Indian problem, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of innovation comes from there, and they would be first to market and all those kinds of things. So I think that's one. The second, I think, is around consumer. And this is something that I was having a chat with Kaushik from EQT. And and we were discussing how for a lot of consumer companies, they're anyways targeting sort of the top 1% of India. If you look at things like Ola and Uber and stuff like that, you know, like it's only the top 1-5% of the country which can even afford spending 300 rupees for a, you know, 5-mile cab ride. A lot of those products could potentially find a market in Europe as well, from a consumer perspective. So I think those would be the two, you know, obvious places for one to start. And third would be like if people are interested in fields that Europe has an inherent advantage in, like climate, sustainability, you know, hard sciences, materials, and things like that. I think there's a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. I mean, we've had, again, on this podcast, a number of conversations, especially with Italian VCs around exactly this problem. So in Italy, you have incredible education systems, right? So, in, you know, the postdocs that come out of Italy are some of the, you know, the smartest people in the world, but there is no ecosystem for them to enter into in Italy. So therefore they end up coming to the UK or they go to the US or et cetera. Yeah. So it seems sensible that if you're able to harness those, and by the way, salaries in Italy are equally awful. And, you know, you have all sorts of other sort of problems around the employment laws and so on. If you're thinking about building a fast growth tech business, and therefore if you're able to attract that sort of talent, you know, and bring them over to India, then you could really level up the entire sort of talent pool, right? So it's talent density essentially that you're improving. But I guess the point though, and this kind of ties all of the things that you mentioned there together, is how does India market itself to Europe and how does Europe market itself to India? Because at the moment, it doesn't feel like that conversation is happening. You know, in the US, it feels like people are aware of the Sundar Pichais and so on of the world, right? So they know that there is, you know, there are incredible VCs, et cetera, et cetera, within, whether it's crypto, whether it's Kozla, whether it's, you know, whoever it is, right? Balaraj, right? Like these people exist, people know about them and those conversations there. Whereas it feels like in Europe, there's also this hesitation about, well, should we be going to the ex-colony almost, right? To search for talent. Like it's almost an admission of, you know, the student has become the teacher, right? Like there's a little bit of reluctance to do that. Do you think that that's the case? Or is it just simply that they are neither Europe nor India is marketing itself to the other particularly well?
I think they market specific things. Mm-hmm. So they will market trade MOUs.
Yeah, or India will market its low-cost environment.
It's like what's the difference between a Y Combinator hacker meetup and the World Economic Forum? Where are you going to find founders?
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what you would see, there's absolutely a lot of trade exchange between India and Europe, right? There are these councils and stuff like that. But like the people that you're going to find there would be, there'd be some trade delegation.
It's the old economy kind of.
It would be either that, you'd find like Big Four and, you know, a couple of ministers and stuff like that. But what you need are, I think two things that will change, right? One is that we need to highlight more success stories as they come. Like I've been trying to do it in a tiny way. Like, for example, I made a list of all the founders that have gone ahead and raised a bunch of money sitting in Europe or of South Asian origin, right? Like, there's a bunch of unicorns that have started. Nobody talks about them. Nobody knows.
I wouldn't know the names, right?
Exactly. Yeah. There's a bunch of them. Like, Wave was started by an Indian, one of the co-founders, which probably is, I think they raised, what, a $2 billion round recently? Mm. And there's a bunch of other unicorn startups. Nobody's talking about it, right? So I think it starts from there. If you look at, you know, one of the things I was doing was I made a list of who are the, you know, richest Indians or the most successful Indians. And I looked at beyond the first few, right? Beyond Lakshmi Nivas Mittal and Hindujas and all. Start moving to the next list and type their name in YouTube. You won't find a single interview.
Yeah, sure.
So either they're hiding.
Yeah.
And they don't want people to know how successful they are. Or nobody's nobody cares about them.
Well, no one's thought about
Nobody's thought about it, right? Yeah. Like, you know, why aren't there 100 interviews of Shamil, the founder of Dishoom?
Note to self. Get the list from Rishabh and interview them all on Nothing Ventured.
Yeah, and it need not be even tech founders, right? Like I was talking about, like the Dishoom founder.
Yeah.
He's got an incredible story, right? Like, why isn't he on more podcasts?
So
I think.
I actually have a view on that, by the way. I think Indians in general tend to shy away from publicity. They like to be slightly private or quite private.
I think that's BS, man. Look at the Indians in the US. You think Instacart CEO shies
maybe it's just European.
Have you seen Arvind of Perplexity, man? Like, hasn't he gone crazy on Twitter?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think it's more to do with the culture that you're around.
So maybe that's it. Yeah.
British culture, European culture. I mean, the whole sucking at PR thing applies to the whole of Europe.
Yeah, sure.
Right?
Like, yeah.
The fact that, like, think of it. Do people think of Intercom and Stripe as European companies, Datadog as European companies? No, they'll be like, hey, it started in America. Just like how people think Postman started in the US. Postman is an Indian company. I think Stripe is a very European company.
Yeah.
Why isn't Europe going crazy saying, yeah, you know what?
These Irish founders.
Yeah, it's really our company, right? Like the founders moved there for YC, but it's not like, you know, they're not Irish in any way. So, I mean, it's about, there is a bit of a hype angle as well. And I think, you know, America tends to sometimes exaggerate. You know, it's like the fake it till you make it. You know, Europe would be like, they would undersell. So I think there's a bit of that probably. But I think that's one part which is really important. Because people in, like, I was surprised why I found out about the Global Talent Visa.
Yeah.
Right? Here's a visa where you write a 20-page application. You need 10 pieces of evidence. And it gives you permanent residency in 3 years.
Mm.
Like there should be a banner. There should be a billboard of this in Bangalore.
Mm.
Right? And the Department of Business and Trade should go on to the 5 most popular podcasts. And talk about this and then see how many people apply.
Yeah.
That's not happening, right? So I think...
But this is why... So it's a PR... It's like a PR problem. It's a comms problem.
I think it's a PR and having an aggressive strategy to go after an outcome, right? Like, do you want it to happen? And absolutely, you want it to happen, right? The second part is that you need more stories, right? So think about what one Flipkart did to the Indian ecosystem.
Yeah.
Like, in many ways, the Flipkart exit, up till the Flipkart exit didn't happen, a lot of mainstream investors, like if you look at the funds that were allocating to India, it was very tiny. There were like 4-5 funds and like the whole ecosystem was still about offshoring. It wasn't like homegrown. I think Flipkart was so important that exit, it just put everything, like a $21 billion exit. It just this
it
is
catalyzed
how,
the whole.
Yeah, this is when your parents message you on WhatsApp saying, "Hey, have you heard of this guy? He sold." And I think something like that needs to happen in Europe. So I think imagine if I don't know, if something like Wave tomorrow goes public, or any of these companies, right?
But then equally, the founders need to also really step up and represent their background, right? Like, so they should not be shy of saying, you know, we're proudly Indian, but we decided to build this in Europe or whatever for whatever reason.
And that depends because see, I mean, a lot of the companies that have grown so far are second generation Indians, and so they have a bit of a dual identity, and so they are British with Indian heritage, right? I think the whole idea of an first generation person coming here and starting a company, it's only happening now, right? So if you look at, for example, Avinav Nigam, who started a company called Imo, and now he's running something called Turn Group, which is trying to solve a huge problem of healthcare recruitment. This could become a $1 billion company.
Mm.
And he's the first gen, like he came to this country maybe 6-7 years ago, right? There's going to be a lot of those kinds of folks as well. And I think, you know, it's both of these things are going to happen. I think just honestly, I don't care whether it's first or second generation Indians. I think it's important that you have like a big, like imagine if Revolut was started by an Indian person.
Yeah, we wouldn't, everyone
would
be
talking about that. There would be Arnab Goswami on Indian media saying you know, an Indian guy created like the largest fintech company in the world or something like that, right? So I think once, you know, a couple of those things happen, it's just the law of numbers, right? It's bound to happen.
Yeah, yeah. It's essentially portfolio theory or power law. At some point, we'll see it happening. It's just the number of bets that are taken. And just for clarification, whilst my brain was not working, I was thinking about Balaji Srinivas from Andreessen Horowitz when I was completely blanking on his name. I think this opportunity to really shout from the rafters about the opportunity both in India and of Indians in Europe or elsewhere is immense. I mean, even if you look at, I mean, like, you know, going back to my grandfather's generation and my father's generation, they were the industrialists in Africa, for example, right? They came there with literally nothing. I mean, you know, my grandfather arrived with his brothers because they were dying from famine in Gujarat, right, in the early 1900s. And from there, did all the usual entrepreneurial things that, like, you know, the Indian diaspora is so famous for having done, and you know, built industrial businesses. And I think now, to your point, it's now, okay, this next wave, this next generation of Indian entrepreneurs are not building pharma companies, they're not building factories, they're building tech. And actually, when you see one of those large things, then Tata became an incredibly well-known name even here in the UK. Why? Because, you know, he was buying out steel plants in Wales or wherever it was. When you start seeing that sort of activity, people step up and notice, and then they start thinking, well, okay, maybe I need to be paying attention to what's happening.
And
there.
It's the entire ecosystem as well, right? So for example, if you look at the five largest funds in Europe by AUM, right? How many of them have an Indian partner?
They don't have.
I'm talking about like a GP, right?
Yeah,
the Mark Andreessen equivalents, they don't. So when it comes to venture, so you'll find a lot of emerging funds.
Yep.
And you would have had a lot of them on the show as well.
Yep.
A lot of emerging funds, a lot of sort of non-GP at some of the large funds slowly starting to happen. You see a lot of associates, principals and stuff like that. But I think the moment, that's the other part that would start happening as well. Because it, like in the US, for example, there are, there's a lot of funds, a lot of well-known funds who have specific programs targeting, say, the IITians or the Indian diaspora.
Yeah.
They won't...
IIT is the Indian Institute for Technology, for those that don't know.
Yeah. Now, they wouldn't call it out that, but when
but
you talk to them,
that's
essentially what they're doing, right? Yeah. They're hosting meetups for this specific group.
Well, it's what the Singapore government does as well, right? They target graduates from the IIT, IIM, because they know they're going to be the best.
I think you'll start seeing initiatives like that starting to happen. I think a lot of the large Indian funds should probably start having a cross-border angle. It's just that today they are building the India-US corridor, and it makes sense because that's the biggest market.
Yeah.
But at some point in the next coming decade, either it'll get so crowded or they would have already put their foot there and now they're thinking of the next thing. Like if you've got 20 billion in AUM, where are you going to deploy it, right? Mm. So you'll start thinking of other geographies, and I think a few of them will start coming here as well. And that's when you'll have a lot of cross-border stuff. I think some of the European funds will start thinking about, because that's the other part, right? Like if you have a general partner who's deciding the investment strategy of a fund and that person happens to be from India, they might be able to, you know, create other kinds of, you know, internal.
Well, we've had on the podcast Leo Capital, you know, Shwetank Verma, you know, Indian fund now launching in the Nordics, right? Like and cross pollinating what they've learned from India into you know, into that region. I think these things take time. And to your point, at the moment, yes, lots of emerging managers, but none sitting at the helm of any of the, you know, the behemoth funds or the really large funds. But again, that's a matter of time, right? Like all of these things. And I think Indians in general play the long game. Like they're not, you know, they're not necessarily worried about can we make it happen in the next 1 or 5 years. They're looking at the 10, 20 year kind of horizon.
Yeah. Like imagine a situation where as part of, say, the India-UK trade relationship, one of the things they say is that we will earmark $1 billion,
yeah,
where both the countries say 500 million and we'll go invest in funds which are investing in this corridor.
Yeah.
You have to give an incentive,
yeah,
for people to start doing it, right? That's one of the ways to maybe start some of
this. Yeah, you need to start from somewhere. But let's move on to Swagat, right? Because this conversation grew out of a WhatsApp group that we are both on called the Deshi Tech Mafia. Ping me if you want details. I'm not sure if I can get you in, but I will ask politely to the admins. But this was exactly your point. You talked about it earlier, right? Like it's a great chat and you know, incredible people on there, many of whom are founders or VCs or from the ecosystem, but it is not a business chat by any stretch of the imagination. It is a very social one. You know, I think the most recent post was a Diwali dinner, right? Held a couple of nights ago. So you're building Swagat to essentially try and connect this quite disparate diaspora of South Asian founders and operators working in tech in Europe. So what has been the role of the Indian diaspora in shaping that European tech ecosystem today? And despite the fact that we have so many Indian founded, you know, European unicorns, why don't we see these prominent role models spoken about more? Like, I mean, you know, yes, you need that big exit, et cetera, but even now there are so many names that one could talk about. Why are we not talking about what, and how does Swagat help develop, that narrative?
Yeah. I think there's a couple of different questions here. I think on the first one, which is why doesn't it happen? There could be multiple reasons. Mm. One is that people are just busy trying to, you know, get by.
Yeah.
And so the second generation Indians, I think many of them do wear it on their sleeve. Mm-hmm. And I think the first generation Indians are just getting here to, like. I think they're still trying to figure out if they've made it or not, right? Before they start talking about it.
The second part is
that I think many of them landed up here because they couldn't go to the US.
Yeah, you okay? Yeah.
And so it's they're sort of in between trying to figure out, are we committing to this continent or not? Where immigration is thought of as an optionality, at least through my conversations, that's something that I notice. But I think I don't know why people have not actually, you know, there have been a lot of initiatives. Like, for example, I know the Bay HQ.
Amardeep.
They do a lot of incredible things around showcasing, the diaspora. There's another initiative. I think it's Brit Punjab or something like that. Yeah. There's that whole Brit Punjab. Sort of, I know they've got a channel. There are initiatives like Indiaspora, which are now launching in the UK. But it's still very, it still feels like it's not come together fully. Right?
Yeah, but I also wonder, right? And so I'm a second generation East African Indian, right? So I would say that my cultural identity is probably closer to East Africa than it is to India, right? Because I'm now 100-something years, yeah, away from, you know, having been in India. I don't have family really there anymore. Yeah. We're definitely more likely to go to Kenya than we are to India. So, you know, how do I see myself? I probably see myself as British of East African Indian descent, right? So you start also having these degrees of separation from your cultural identity from the initial state. And I wonder whether, and I'm sure many Indians do, right? They assimilate quite quickly into the population, right? There are these tropes of, well, there's communities of people that only speak within their own language. I don't think those are the people that you and I speak to day to day, right? They are working in industry, in tech, you know, alongside their peers from all sorts of places, not just India, right? And I wonder how, so this is an open question, you almost certainly won't have the answer. I wonder how many of them sort of see themselves as Indians in Europe or European Indians, right? And how that plays into, you know, how they think about and talk about themselves.
I think it plays a big role because as you said, right? Like if your you know, heritage is East Africa, obviously you're gonna think more about that. That's the culture that you will relate more to. And so now if somebody comes from India and starts talking about very specific esoteric things which two people who've grown up in India would know about, you know, and so typically what ends up happening in these kinds of things is that there becomes like the least common denominator, food or common stories, you know.
And again, because we're talking about 1.5 billion people, right?
But, like, but I think these things evolve over time as well, right? Because like, I'm just thinking that even like the group that's met on Desi Tech Mafia or people who are in Swagat, you know, as you're going to go through the evolution of maturity of an ecosystem, like imagine if you're going to go start something else. Chances are that you will end up recruiting somebody from this group of people that you've
because you've met them. Sure.
And then they will bring in their friends, and like that's how a lot of these things grow. And my sense is that some of these things just take time. But yeah, I think there's absolutely this whole dual identity stuff, and then you just find things that are common. So like what I realized was when I started Swagat, I absolutely realized this, and so I indexed it a little bit more on the fresh off the boat Indians who are, you know, first generation, very common problems.
How do, like, I open a bank account?
Like you're not gonna be able to relate to a problem of immigration, getting an ILR today, right? Your parents would have faced that, but like you're like,
but they probably wouldn't have either, because they would have been under the British, like, so
exactly.
So
I think there'll be things like that. And so I started indexing a lot on folks who've just come in the last 10 years. They have some very unique challenges. For example, immigration is one of them. Being able to, like, imagine if you've not worked at a Google or an Amazon in India and you've landed up here and you worked at a company which has done incredibly well in India.
But no one knows about it.
That work experience might be discounted in Europe. Even though that company might be far larger than the company you're interviewing for. Right? Imagine you worked at RazorPay in India. RazorPay is like worth $5 billion. Right? And now you're talking to like a Series A company and they're like, oh, well, what have you done? So I think there's
well, let me just show you.
Like I had a very close friend of mine was the first CMO of a company which is now worth like $10 billion, right? And he had like seed stage startups quiz him. And I'm like, dude, you're going to get a $500,000 pay packet in India, right? Like, so I think there are some unique challenges, and this plays out when you decide to start up as well. So like, you know, imagine you go to a VC.
Yeah, you don't have a pedigree.
He has no idea. He or she has no idea about your startup in India or where you worked, and now you're trying to go raise a $2 million seed round. Good luck. The advice given to that person would be, hey, either go work at a brand name company or find somebody local who
you can co-found with and can be the face. Or go and...
Or just apply to YC.
Or go do like an MBA INSEAD and then build a network or whatever, right?
I think most people will just apply to YC. That's what they'll go.
Well, they're letting everyone in, so it's like pretty, it's pretty easy.
So I think there's some of those unique challenges. So like in the community, for example, I think there must be about 200 operators and founders. Like literally, like I think the first couple of hours in my day, every day, is just catching up on email and DMs from people. Literally, one of the things that I've done, I think I just open sourced all the knowledge in the community where I'm like, hey, here's a sheet. Here are the 300 investors at the partner level that I know. If you're starting up and you want intro to any of these people,
just let me know.
Just let me know. I'll put in a warm intro to them, right? Or like, here is what immigration looks like in all of these five countries. If you want a permanent residency, here are the people who've gotten a green card. Here are the people who've gotten an ILR. People who've got an EU blue card. So the idea was that if you, chances are that you would have a bunch of common connections. But if you just say, you know what, here's the value, you know, then it starts building trust. Because I'm not going to assume that somebody's going to come and give back to the community. They're like, dude, I've got my own problems.
You got to, you absolutely got to give before you.
Here's everything.
Yeah.
Tell me how I can help.
Yeah.
And you hope that after you do all that, then at some point they're going to come and give back to the community, right? That's how a lot of these things.
And well, but that's the reality, right? If you make things frictionless for people, then they're that much, they're going to be that much happier to support down the track when someone else has a problem, right? Like we see this all the time in the CFO community that we have, which is quite small and fairly focused, right, based on what we do. But the community is massively supportive of each other, right? Whether they're working on deals from my business or not, we, you know, where we have an opinion or where we've seen something that someone hasn't seen elsewhere, we're always like straight on it, because actually the more we can build each other up, the better chance that we have collective success, right, over the the longer term.
No, absolutely. And I think there's something to be said about doing it in a way which builds genuinely deep and strong bonds, because the diaspora is also extremely competitive. and I think the listeners of the show who've either grown up in, you know, South Asian households or lived in the countries know what I'm referring to. Like, it's an extremely cutthroat
community. Yeah, I mean, the joke was if Kamala Harris became president, then essentially that would be like, okay, it's no longer Sundar Pichai, now you got to aim even higher, like you too can be president if you
of
really
of course try. You gotta there's no other way, nothing else is good enough. So I think it's really important that, you know, people genuinely sort of, you know, find value and then they sort of, you know, come back and give back. And I think there's enough examples of that I think there's a lot of that happening here as well, but it just needs to be done in a more structured format, focused on specific things, right?
So then a question, right? So as you said, you're currently focused, or you initially focused on very much sort of like people who had freshly landed in Europe, right? Would it make sense though to open up the community there to people from a broader or from the diaspora more broadly, because they will also have certain experiences that, you know, a first time person landing will not have had the same. You know, when you've been in a country for 5 years, you have different problems, like what tax, how do I shelter, what do I, you know, what do I do? But then equally, I was thinking to myself, like, would I be able to add value to a community like this? And I'm not sure that I could, because my experience is fundamentally as a British citizen, right? And that's where I've grown up. I've lived in other parts of the world. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But, you know, I've not had any of those challenges, right? Like, I can transfer money very easily. I can pretty much land in, like, I don't know how many countries and just get an on-arrival visa, right? Like, my wife is Italian, so we can go to Italy. Like, there's lots of easy stuff that...
I agree.
Yeah.
But I think it's just... It's an evolution, right? I think the thing that's important in any community is the quality of conversations and the value that people are getting.
Sure.
And so up till now, it's just been, you know, literally it's a closed door thing. And so it's works through referrals. And there are people who are second generation Indians who've also become part of it. But I want to let it organically grow. So if it starts coming in, and it will, I'd be delighted.
Well, the next question to that actually is, okay, would you open it up to Indians who have not yet moved to Europe?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think anyone who is thinking about Europe or cares or is intrigued is planning, absolutely. Because finally, why do you start a community? You initially, just like with a product, you start with a very laser focused, initiative, and then over time it starts expanding,
right? And you also start seeing where are the common problems.
Exactly.
You start with a broad, like, I mean, to your earlier point, right? The founder you talked about a bit earlier, who pivoted, you know, several times, or has doggedly pursued, you know, pursued a pathway to getting to whatever product market fit they've now found. You start with one idea in mind. The final idea is never what it initially started as, right? Yeah. So
and a lot of these things, you let the community sort of take
decide.
Over,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you're sort of there just as a steward, and you know.
Yeah, you moderate, you facilitate. Yeah. But
and the most active user, because you have to be there to, you know, inspire others into action.
I think a lot of people don't talk unless someone else talks first.
Exactly.
So it's being able to kind of spark those conversations.
Yep.
Listen, Rishab, I mean, this has been an incredible conversation so far. I have one final question for you. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending? You don't have to answer, by the way.
I'll have to think. Give me a second.
That's okay.
And you'll record this again, right?
No, we can leave it as is. That's fine. We can leave the gap. The gap's interesting because I think a lot of people, you know, actually the hot take with all of this is there is really no truly contrarian advice or thought that many people have, right? Like, I mean, I think it's very easy to come up with something quite trite in the moment, but actually if you think about it, like I don't think I have an answer to this question.
Yeah, because every time I think about whether it's truly contrary, I'm like, well, this idea probably came from somewhere. But I don't know. I mean, I would say that I would say that if you are a second time founder, I mean, I would be happier if more people, rather than, you know, start companies and spend years trying to figure out PMF, just bought companies.
Yeah.
The whole search fund model, I just think that PMF is so random, and especially if you're deciding to go the venture route. So either you say that, you know what, I don't want it to be the venture route. You're making money from day one. It might not be venture scale, but it's, you know, but this whole, you know.
I mean, there's something lovely about free cash flow, let's face it, right?
This whole go big or go home kind of stuff. I mean, if that is the game that you're playing, ideally, there should be more people who are just buying out PMF, right? Like, and we've seen a few examples of it, but like, why this fascination with, you know, I want to build it from scratch.
Well, I think that is the...
If most ideas fail, then you should have enough bargains available in the market.
But that is very clearly the case, certainly in Europe and certainly today. It's happening. Yeah. And I love that piece of advice myself, because it is something that we think about a lot, right? How many founders should actually go down
community.
That?
They're always thinking about...
Well, I mean, but the point is also like how, you know... Realistically, how many businesses should go out and raise venture? Very, very, very few. Now, the problem with venture is that because of the nature of portfolio managers, like they have to take enough bets. So that encourages more people to raise from venture. But actually, the reality is that A, very few are going to succeed, but B, very few were ever set up really to work for the venture model. So, you know, and yes, there will be lots of assets fairly highly discounted, I think, coming onto the market very soon. Listen, Rishab, it's been absolutely amazing having this conversation with you. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they find you on the internet?
I'm on LinkedIn, so linkedin.com/in/Rishab Goyal. Same thing on Twitter. And you can check out my podcast called The Swagat Show on YouTube. So... yeah, that's
amazing. That's and of course, swagat.in for the community, right?
Yes.
Amazing. We will be dropping links to those in the show notes. For the time being, Rishab, thank you so much for joining. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun, and just absolutely love what you're doing.
Amazing. Thank you.